A new poll says faith leaders are the most impactful messengers regarding vaccines. Well, how do faith leaders see their role? From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Tuesday, May 11th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome Bishop Constanza Hagmeier for a conversation about the pandemic and leadership in communities of faith. We talk about advancements in stroke treatment and why minutes count when you experience symptoms. Then a new autobiography of a South Dakota governor, Political Defeat, allowed William J. Bulow to write his memoir, and it laid unread for decades. Tony Venhuizen joins us for a look at how it came to light. Plus, the Taoism of author Ursula Le Guin. Marcia Mittman joins us in conjunction with Spearfish's Big Read programming. That's coming later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary. MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell held a free rally Monday at Mitchell's Corn Palace to promote his new website, frankspeech.com. Joshua Heyer was there.
About 1,000 people showed up for the event. Some traveled hours to attend.
Iowa. Where? Texas. Washington, D.C. What? Oh, pray for that poor guy, will you? Minnesota?
The rally featured guest speakers, including 1980s Saturday Night Live star Joe Piscopo. Attendees were given a free copy of Lindell's autobiography, What Are the Odds?, and his docu-movie, Absolute Proof, Exposing Election Fraud and the Theft of America. Lindell started Frank's Speech after he was kicked off Twitter and other platforms. He was banned for spreading conspiracy theories and baseless claims that former President Trump won the 2020 election.
And that's where it became, it was about, six, 8 weeks ago now, I said, we've got to come up with a platform to bring the broadcasters over where we can put our voice out. And not just me, but all of them. All the ones that are kicked off of YouTube, the radio stations, the TV, the podcasts, they're all coming over to frankspeech.com.
Lindell is a recovered crack addict from Minnesota who's made a fortune selling pillows. He has considered running for political office and is an outspoken supporter of former President Donald Trump. Frank's Speech is advertised as a social media site, but it currently does not operate that way. It's a one-way communication platform where Lindell and a handful of others circulate information, including allegations of voter fraud and criticism of COVID-19 vaccines. The website bills itself as, quote, the voice of free speech, but the terms of service ban some forms of speech, including swearing and the use of the Lord's name in vain. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Joshua Heyer in Mitchell.
The U.S. Forest Service is restoring the health of aspen and ponderosa pine stands in the western Black Hills. Jeffrey Underhill works for the Black Hills National Forest. He says the project will remove spruce trees to allow for natural regrowth or planting of ponderosa and aspen. Underhill says modern fire suppression allows spruce trees to dominate.
So this is a pretty common thing across the western United States where you remove the disturbance that maintain one species or two, in this case aspen and ponderosa pine in these systems. And with that disturbance no longer there, then another species like spruce expands and does really well under those conditions.
Underhill says logging contractors will remove most of the excess spruce. The Hell Canyon Ranger District is accepting public comments on the project until May 14th. A Delta Airlines regional jet landed safely in Rapid City after mechanical problems were reported. The airline says in a statement that Flight 5057, operated by Endeavor Air from Minneapolis-St. Paul to Rapid City, encountered a, quote, performance issue with one of the CRJ-200 aircraft's two engines during its descent, end quote, into Rapid City Sunday night. No injuries were reported. Temperatures in the mid to upper 30s tonight with scattered showers in the west. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Several school districts across the state are reevaluating their mask and face covering policies just weeks before the end of the semester. Rapid City Area School District surveyed parents for their thoughts on masks, and the school board decided to continue the current policy last night in a vote. Superintendent Lori Simon joins us with an update. Superintendent Simon, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Glad to be here, Lori.
Tell me why reevaluate this policy at this time with, 11 days left in the school year?
Yes. You know, I think it really was the result of some inquiries to the Board of Education about the mask policy and whether or not we would consider lifting the mandate for the rest of the year. And that is really what led the board to asking us to put out a survey, and which led to the vote last night.
And what did parents say in the survey? What did you learn from the parents' point of view?
It was a very simple one-sentence survey, but what we did learn in the survey was that of our families who responded, 67% of families supported lifting the mandate for the rest of the school year, and 60% of our staff supported lifting the mandate. We had sort of the opposite last night at our board meeting in terms of who came to speak to this issue at open forum. Of the 12 people that did come to speak to the mask mandate, two-thirds supported keeping masks for the rest of the year. And, you know, I think there were passionate arguments certainly on both sides. And I think, you know, the board made the decision looking at the fact that there are only 11 in-person school days remaining, and just felt that it was the safest course of action, particularly as we think about our seniors and graduation being so close, certainly not wanting to jeopardize any seniors' opportunity to walk the stage.
Yeah. Tell us what happens next then. No change and summer activities or summer schools. What's changing going into the next few months?
Yes. So we have already developed our back to school plans for next year and already brought them forward for discussion with the board. And it really is a fairly return to normal for the next school year. And so as of the last day of school, which is May 27th, our current plan will sunset, and beginning this summer, and that does include summer school and activities, there will not be a mask mandate.
Let's talk a little bit about coronavirus money and funding and some grant applications that you have in to improve the school facilities in Rapid City. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so we were really fortunate. These dollars are allocated from the Federal Department of Ed based on your free and reduced lunch overall count. And so even though we're roughly half the size as Sioux Falls, we received roughly the same amount of money. And so it is a lot of money to spend in a very short period of time. And so we really looked at it as a golden opportunity to address some pretty significant facility needs under this new allowable criteria that is part of the ESSER 2 and ESSER 3 guidance. And so we have already begun that pre-approval process with the State Department of Education. We're just awaiting, as I understand it, the final federal guidance before we'll be able to finalize that pre-approval.
And the goal is to build two new schools? Tell us specifically what we're talking about here, because there was the bond measure that was unsuccessful in Rapid City to replace these facilities.
Yes. And so what we did is looked at that bond list, and that ask at that point was $189.5 million, and we took the two top priorities from that list as identified in a formal facilities analysis that we actually had done the spring before my arrival. And so the two facilities deemed the worst condition overall in terms of not only educational suitability, but overall condition and structural integrity were South Middle School, followed by Robbinsdale Elementary. And so, yes, if approved, our plan will build a new South Middle School, slightly larger, on the same site, and will replace Robbinsdale Elementary, and we would build a slightly larger elementary on our Parkview location, which is a little bit to the south.
Yeah, and you said these are allowable criteria, so help people understand, is it a crowding issue? Like, how does it tie in to that criteria that says it qualifies for what is essentially coronavirus relief funding?
Yes, so that is part of the pre-approval process, but certainly when you look at learning loss, air quality, learning environment, you know, all of those criteria are addressed not only in our application but in the ESSER overall criteria for how you can spend these dollars. And so we really think that by replacing these facilities, which we have seen this year, educational suitability issues, certainly in terms of more space needed because of the crowding in these older schools that were built with much smaller classrooms, we will be able to address not only air quality, having adequate space, but a proper learning environment for these students. And I think it's also important to note that these both of these schools that we would be replacing serve a high number not only of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch, but also high numbers and percentages of Indigenous students. And so when we think about the new criteria that has been added to ESSER, certainly it meets and follows the spirit of some of that new criteria in terms of the students being served as well.
Superintendent Lori Simon with Rapid City Area School District, thank you so much for being here with us today.
You're very welcome, Lori. Thank you.
Ahead on the program, we talk about Stroke Month and advancements in stroke treatment and how you can prevent. You're on listener-supported SDPU Radio.
Nearly a year after the murder of George Floyd, weeks after the conviction of the officer who killed him, we check in with three Black police officers on what's changed and what hasn't.
The culture of policing, officers don't want that culture to change. And the officers that I deal with, they don't like to be held accountable.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Whether you listen for a few minutes a day or a few hours, whether you're listening for hard news or something less serious, when you listen to NPR and SDPB, you're trusting us to be a part of your day, to curate the news and information that's important to you. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang. Help SDPB continue to be the source you count on. Make a gift at sdpb.org today, and thank you.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. May is National Stroke Awareness Month. Dr. Divyat Sandhu from Sanford Health joins us now to talk about prevention, symptoms, and the latest research on stroke. Dr. Sandhu, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First, tell us a little bit about how common a stroke is here in South Dakota and really nationwide.
So the nationwide numbers are about 800,000 new strokes every year, and those numbers are fairly consistent across all of our states and are based on the population. There's a few higher incidents of stroke states, and those are mostly in the south. So very common in the population of about 300 million. We have 800,000 new strokes every year.
That seems awfully high. So this is a fairly common problem in America.
Very much so. Absolutely. Yeah. One of the top four most common diseases that cause both death and, more importantly, disability. Stroke is actually higher than most other diseases that we have in the U.S. When it comes to causing long-term disability, simply because of the effects that it has on people.
So tell us, for people who aren't quite, don't have their mind wrapped around it, what exactly is stroke?
So think of it as an interruption in blood flow to a certain part of the brain for long enough that the part of the brain that had its blood flow cut off was not getting enough oxygen and suffered permanent damage. Once damage sets in the brain, it is fairly quick and it is permanent. And because of that, what happens is, depending on the location of the stroke, you have a variety of signs and symptoms that a person might experience. So that at its core is what a stroke is. Lack of blood supply, therefore lack of oxygen and glucose to a certain part of the brain for long enough that it suffers irreversible damage.
Now, there was a time when there wasn't a whole lot doctors could do. What kind of critical breakthroughs have we seen in stroke treatment?
Going back from 1994 onwards, there's been several. The first one from 1994 was the use of the intravenous medicine, which was fairly successful at breaking open clots. Then over the course of the next 20-some years, we found out that the intravenous medicine, the clot-breaking medicine that worked better for smaller blood clots, didn't work as well for the larger ones. Then, starting from about 2007, we started developing things along the lines of mechanical devices that you could introduce into a person's arteries and then navigate them all the way up to the site of the blockage itself, and then remove the blockage. From 2007 on to about 2015, with more dedicated and specialized imaging, things like CAT scans and brain MRIs, plus gradual improvement in the quality of these devices at our disposal, we now have numerous devices which we can use in several medium to small, even-sized blood vessels in the brain and use them to open these blockages. And with these latest treatments, the ones that have come on in the past 6 years or so, the time period that's available for us to offer these treatments to patients has gone from 4.5 hours to, in certain cases, more than 24 hours after a person starts experiencing stroke symptoms.
All right, let's let people know what those symptoms are and why getting then to your emergency room is so important to do as quickly as possible. What are you looking for when it comes to symptoms?
So the mnemonic that hopefully a lot of us will be seeing and hearing a lot about is called BEFAST, B-E-F-A-S-T. And the B in that stands for balance, which is a sudden loss of balance, a sudden unsteadiness, a sudden inability to walk. E is for eyes, and what that means is, again, sudden double vision, loss of vision on one side of a person's field of vision. F is for face, and what that means is a couple of things. One, that you have a face that is asymmetric, drooping on one side compared to the other. And because of that, you have slurred speech or incomprehensible speech. A is for arm, and it also includes leg. What that means is either weakness of an arm and a leg on the same side, or clumsiness of arm or leg on the same side. S is speech, and this goes back again to the F that we had just mentioned, and this again is slurred speech or inability to produce any comprehensible speech. And that T at the end, that's for time. And that speaks to the importance, the critical importance of early action. Earliest possible action is the best possible action, because even though I had just said that we now have ability to treat strokes up to 24 hours after they first start, even with those implements, those tools at our disposal, the earlier a person gets to a hospital where they can be offered these tools and techniques, the better it is. Yeah. And this is across the board, and this is one thing that has not changed ever since we started doing that intravenous medicine in 1994.
Good stuff to think of. May is National Stroke Awareness Month, and this is just our time to send that message out once again. It's a message that can save lives. Dr. Sandhu, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead on the program, we have Bishop Constanza Hagmeyer. We'll talk about a new SDSU poll that says it's faith leaders that can be the most impactful messengers about the COVID-19 vaccine. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Francisco Goldman. His book, The Art of Political Murder, about the assassination of a Guatemalan human rights activist, was adapted into an HBO documentary. His novel, Say Her Name, is a fictionalized account of the tragic death of his wife in a body surfing accident. He has a new autobiographical novel called Monkey Boy. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by Sanford Underground Research Facility, advancing South Dakota's economy, creating jobs that support world-leading science, education, and our communities. More about America's Underground Research Laboratory at sanfordlab.org.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. Mornings go best if you know where the essentials are. You wake up, there's the coffee, the toothpaste, the soap, or maybe just the snooze button. Morning Edition from NPR News, that's always easy to find. On your radio, your phone, or your laptop. Count on us to keep you company as you start your day. Listen every weekday.
Join us weekdays at 5 a.m. Central and weekends at 7 a.m. Central on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Program funding is provided by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City, offering a broad range of insurance products to protect you and your family at every stage of life. GeneHufford.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. A recent SDSU poll found that faith leaders could be the most impactful messengers regarding COVID-19 vaccines. So that got us wondering, how do faith leaders feel about their role during the pandemic? Today, we welcome Bishop Constanza Hagmeyer with the ELCA South Dakota Synod back to In the Moment. Bishop Hagmeyer, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's good to be back, Lori.
Now, we had a conversation with Dave Wiltsy and Philippe Viscovich about this SDSU poll, and they did a survey experiment where they showed the same message coming from, they had a control group, and then they showed the same message about COVID vaccinations from political leaders, from medical leaders, and from faith leaders. And by far, the faith leaders were the most trusted deliverers of that message. And that made us think about how you might see this. First of all, does that finding surprise you that people would be more willing to trust and act on a message they got from someone that they consider a leader of their faith community?
Well, it does not surprise me, but it delights me that we as faith leaders still have that much weight in people's decision making process. So it doesn't surprise me, but it delights me is my my answer to that question. Because we get invited into people's most intimate moments, really, when life begins and when life ends. So there's this vulnerability that we share as parish pastors with our parishioners.
So if someone called you and said, I understand that I have this, you know, this impact potential, but I want to be very careful with how I use it regarding the COVID vaccine, because in my congregation, in my Bible study, you know, this is a divisive issue, for example. How do you suggest that people sort of move forward? And I'm guessing it connects with what you've already been doing with, during the entire pandemic.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you asked that question, because I just listened to a podcast that wrestled with this reality, as we see numbers throughout the U.S. kind of flatten out with vaccinations. And so I wondered, too, what could we do? And I just wrote a piece that goes out to congregations where I actually very publicly admit that I'm one of the people that was a little reluctant to receive the vaccination. I was a little cautious. There were questions I had, and it went all so fast, and it was challenging for me to wrap my heart and my mind around all of this while still grappling with the reality of the pandemic. But then through cautious and careful conversations with scientists, medical professionals, healthcare professionals, I came to the realization that these voices are voices I trust, and that I received my vaccinations. And so for me, what was most helpful as someone that joined this conversation as someone that was reluctant, was the gift of listening and answering the questions I had with all sincerity, and not brushing me off to the side, but taking me serious along with my questions, and not as a challenger or as an opponent. And so answering your question, how would I advise clergy or any faith community leader it's being present. Like in any contentious, conflicting conversation, be present and listen to what that person you're in conversation with is actually wrestling with.
Yeah, I think that's
the best gift.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because I think it's easy to fall into this idea of if somebody is hesitant to get the vaccine, that means, you know, something. Insert your own stereotype there. And really, those questions are really important to ask and important to sort of dig deep. That just means that you care and you're paying attention to the complexity of this time. And someone called me the other day and I said, what is the hesitation? And she said, I don't want to get sick. I'm a mother and moms can't have sick days. And so if I get side effects, it really impacts me, and I'm young and I might not need this. And we had a lovely long conversation about what her concerns were, you know, going forward as it related to her children, because really she wanted to protect her kids, not only from COVID, but from her absence. And it brought us closer. So these relationships can bring people closer, not just divide them. Are you seeing that in the pandemic, that some of these really difficult, gritty, uncomfortable conversations do have a potential in the right format to bring people closer together to a deeper understanding?
I grabbed the word potential. That's my string of hope and my breath of hope, is that as a person of faith, I always have hope, but it's hard right now.
Yeah.
In all honesty, it's very challenging. The pandemic didn't necessarily move us closer together, and now again we need to get this done. Well, if you don't get it done, you must not like your neighbor. And a deep breath and being present with each other is the potential that's there, and I see it happening. on one-to-one basis. Mm-hmm. I just wish, and maybe that's Pollyannish, I just wish we would be able to get some sort of herd mentality to that. We all need to just bring ourselves with listening ears to the table to hear each other in order to give some people time. Some people need a little more time. There's lots for us to process, right?
Right.
Just because the pandemic moved into a different phase doesn't mean that we processed all of that. And now we need to process the next phase of, well, how are we going to get us all herd immunity or immunized? And it's a different phase, but that doesn't mean we're done processing the first one. And I think it just keeps overwhelming people. And some will need a little longer. Some will just be resistant, period. They just don't want the vaccine, right? And then we need to shift our focus to who are we able to have conversations with? And sometimes it means multiple conversations. It's not going to be done after one.
Yeah.
So I think even though we set out with a real high goal, I think eventually we'll get there, but it will take more time, and that we all hoped or wished, or people hoped and wished it would go faster, but nothing really ever gets as fast done as we hope for it. You know, how they say Rome wasn't built in one day.
Right. Meanwhile, people are starting to come back together in spaces that they haven't been for quite some time, including offices, places where you don't necessarily bring your faith in an open conversation because you're at work and you're too busy, or it's just not part of your job to sort of have those conversations. How would we, when we come in contact with one another after such a divisive and isolating time, how do you bring faith into, if you are a person of faith, how do you bring that with you without being, you know, you're in a different context, but yet you want to behave in a certain way, but yet it's really, really hard. You know what I'm saying there? Like, is there a way to bring your faith outside of the pew and into work that works for you without getting in the way of you know, what others are kind of navigating at the same time?
This is most certainly challenging because there are so many layers, right? There's the layer of now we're coming back together. Mm-hmm. And we were so used to working from home. Things have changed. People have changed. This has all changed us. We need to get, again, comfortable with the people that we work with. And again, for me, it's more of a gift of time. In fact, we're so work-driven, right? We need to get the job done now. We can get it done. We're all back together. Let's go do it, do it, do it. In fact, the Synod staff hasn't been together in a year and a few months, and we just celebrated being together. And the only task at hand was to hear each other's story and where are we and how has this impacted us and how are we looking forward and what has it done to us, right? This change in who we are. And so I always say faith is caught, and it's not my saying, I caught it myself. Faith is caught more than it's taught. And I think the best way we can live out our faith is to know that we're not people who pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, but really our assurance lays much deeper, and to give the attention to my neighbor or my colleague without needing to be afraid of my own. So for me, that means I still wear my mask. I'm vaccinated. I understand other people are vaccinated. I might not need to wear my mask in other spaces, but I still do. And even if I'm the only one, I do, because it makes my neighbor be safer who might not yet be vaccinated because they have questions. And so to live out my faith continuously, graciously, and allow other people to ask questions to which I then can answer, not to preach, but to answer their questions, is probably for me the safest way. But again, this coming now back together is another layer that's added and causes anxiety in people's life. You know, we were all hoping we could, but now that it actually happens, there is this apprehension in people's lives.
Another thing this SDSU poll told us was just how many of us lost somebody to COVID or had a friend who was hospitalized, and that might just not be to COVID. There are people who lost, relationships and who grieved deaths from cancer or stroke or heart attack or old age, and maybe didn't get to see their elderly parents before they went, didn't get to have that closure. So we have this river of grief that is flowing through all of our lives in one way or another. You mentioned being with people in these most vulnerable times, including end of life issues. Are there ways to sort of deal with this grief delayed that many of us have experienced during this past year?
Yes, there are many ways. So for me, I have a team that develops resources. We use coaches, grief coaches. We had that very early on already. We consult with therapists, hospital consultants. There is a terminology. It's called institutional betrayal that people deal with, right? First, they were friends in church, for example, and then all of a sudden, this whole pandemic drifted us apart. I mean, we have seen it, right? Right down family lines. That's what you call as institutional betrayal. People feel betrayed by the institution that they're part of, whether it's your family. So there's concepts out there, and in the work that we do and that we help offer to the congregations of the South Dakota Synod are resources that they can use in their congregational context to spark some of creating spaces of intimacy where we can wrestle and grapple with the grief that has struck us on so many different levels. But again, that can only be done when we establish trusted and safe spaces where we can come and bring our vulnerability to the table, can leave it there and know that it's not going to be abused or mistreated or harassed.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are tools, but again, it will take time.
It's heavy work, but there's also a joy in it too. And I've had those flashes of joy when, I saw my niece the other day and her kids looked at me without my mask on and you could just see their faces light up. And I felt a sense of grief that they hadn't seen my face in so long for that moment.
I
thought, oh my word, what have I done? But their joyful faces just let me know. Well, it matters what I do now, too. So we've got good days ahead.
Well, we should do with my own, with my own family. I know our time is coming to an end, but I haven't seen my family in 2 years and one of our sons. And so that was one of the major reasons I got vaccinated. I said, I don't know if I maybe grow green horns in 5 years, right? Because that's a side effect of the vaccine. I'm just joking now. But I want to see my family. That's now very important to me. And I want to see my son. And if I want to travel to Germany, that's the only way I'm going to get it done. So, but it took, it took my own time. And I can't wait to see my parents, not just on FaceTime or Zoom, but actually to be with them. So there's so much. And will it all be joyful? I'm also a little reluctant, right? We haven't seen each other. Has my mom's condition, her health condition changed? Is it going to be worse? What do I expect? So it's very present in all of our lives. And we just need to be patient, number one, with ourselves and then with our neighbor.
Bishop Hagmeier, it is always great to sit in these messy conversations for everyone to listen to with you as we try to figure out what step to take next and with listening, deep listening, and with being present. So thank you for being present with us today.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you.
The South Dakota Air and Space Museum officially launches the 2021 visitor season with its spring takeoff party. It's held at the museum this Saturday, May 15th from 4 to 8 p.m. local time. Old friends or new are welcome. The takeoff party will feature light snacks, beverages, exhibits, as well as a raffle to ride in a World War II airplane. There is a chance of rain in the west beginning tomorrow, lasting through Saturday with highs in the lower 60s, so an umbrella might be good for that spring takeoff party. The Mitchell Area Chamber of Commerce presents a workforce workshop with Mike Henke tomorrow at the Highland Conference Center from 10 to noon. Its theme is Workforce, the Next 10 Years, and How to Thrive. The southeast could see some rain this week, with the best chance on Sunday. Highs should remain in the 60s through the weekend. And get fit for golf clubs from manufacturers like Callaway, Titleist, TaylorMade, and Ping during the Moccasin Creek Demo Show Friday evening. That is at Moccasin Creek Country Club in Aberdeen. It's partly sunny skies each day leading right up to that event. Highs in the northeastern South Dakota in the upper 60s, and there's so much more happening across the state. You can go to our website, sdpb.org, and click on the events calendar. Up next, the unpublished autobiography of a South Dakota governor, Tony Van Huysen, joins us on In the Moment from South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. For decades, underwater photographer Brian Scarry has documented life in the ocean, but he's never understood the secrets of the whales until now.
You reach a rarefied plane when you're in the presence of these highly cognitive, sentient animals like whales. It is like being in the presence of an alien intelligence.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. SDPB has spent the past month shining a spotlight on our relationship with guns in our state. On the next South Dakota Focus, we continue the conversation with legal experts, sports enthusiasts, and people who've experienced gun violence. We'll also learn more about South Dakota youth hunting adventures with our next Good Neighbor. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, we now know a lot more about former South Dakota Governor William J. Bulow, because a manuscript held by his daughter was shared with our next guest, Tony Van Huysen. He's a board member of the Trail of Governors, and he was chief of staff for Governors Noem and Dugard. Well, Van Huysen added annotations and some light editing and provided a 20,000-word selection from the 165,000-word manuscript, all for the latest edition of the South Dakota History Journal. The memoir is called 3 Score Years and 10, and Tony Van Huysen joins us now. Tony, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
This seems like such a treasure, and there was one copy of it in existence. Tell us how this manuscript came to your attention and eventually came into your possession.
Sure. Well, I think it was probably 3 or 4 years ago now, and you mentioned I'm on the board of the Trail of Governors in Pierre, where we're putting up life-size bronze statues of every former governor, and as part of that process, the board members will seek out and try to make contact with family members or descendants of some of the earlier governors so that they're aware of the project, and sometimes they have information to contribute as we plan the concepts for the statues. Sometimes they're in a position to donate financially as well, but we like to make them aware. And so I was talking to a lady from New Jersey, actually Governor Bulow's granddaughter, and we were talking about the project and what information she might have. And she mentioned kind of offhandedly that she had a copy of his autobiography. And I had done a fair amount of research into former governors and history and so forth, and I'd never heard of an autobiography of him. And so I told her that. She explained that after he lost re-election to the U.S. Senate in 1942, that he had retired, stayed in Washington, D.C., bought a typewriter, and just kind of sat down over the next couple of years and typed out his own his biography himself, his autobiography. And so far as she knew, she had the only copy of it. And so I was interested to see this, and I told her that and asked her if there was some way she could, you know, make a copy and send it to me or something. Well, she didn't do that. She just sent me the one original copy, which I received that in the mail and was a little nervous about it because I didn't really want this responsibility. So I ran up to the state library here, and they have big scanners where they can scan documents and archive them, and had him do that and got it back in the mail and back to her within about a day so that I wasn't responsible for the one copy. But we worked off the scan then.
Yeah. So much is in here. And tell me a little bit about his writing style, and then I hope you'll indulge me and let me read for just a minute from the foreword to this book. But what kind of a writer is he, first of all?
Sure. Well, he's very funny, very much a storyteller. He explains, and it's in, I don't think I included this in the excerpt, but at the time he was often compared to Will Rogers for kind of the country folk humor storyteller type. And he actually has a story where he met Will Rogers and the two of them kind of traded stories. So he's a very funny, entertaining guy. Sometimes can be a little long-winded or repetitious in some of these accounts or gets into a lot of detail about some things. And so the excerpt, I tried to trim back on some of that. But the other challenge, and really a lot of what I did, was he grew up speaking German and his schooling was pretty intermittent. He was on a farm really in the wilderness in southern Ohio is where he grew up. And so his spelling and his grammar are really, I'll call it creative, and a lot, and pretty prone to long sentences and no paragraph breaks. And so a lot of what I did was really to make it more readable by correcting the spelling, correcting the punctuation, inserting paragraphs at logical places, and then a lot of annotations too. He'll refer to people or events that would have been familiar in the 1940s, but that a modern reader wouldn't necessarily know what he's talking about. And so I tried to give some context too.
A ton of research for you to annotate that for. And he says in the end of the foreword that, you know, the book is in a long-winded way dedicated to the people who will read it. And you're the person who makes it so people can read this. And that has to feel pretty satisfying, humbling. What word would you use?
Yeah, I think those are both good words. I was just, it's unusual that you find something like this. And I appreciate Nancy Copel was still she just recently retired, but was the director at the State Historical Society Press and was enthusiastic about doing this and printing these excerpts in South Dakota History Journal. So that was good too. You know, he's not exactly a household name these days, but really a lot of, you know, he was part of things that are household names. You know, he was talks about dealing with Guts and Borglum when Mount Rushmore was being built, and talks about he was the governor when Calvin Coolidge spent the summer in Custer State Park, and he was one of the Democrats who helped defeat Franklin Roosevelt's court packing plan in the late 30s. And so these are things that are still talked about today, and he was right in the middle of them.
I want to read just a little bit from his foreword here where he talks about how he got into politics, and he's really kind of wrestling through several hundred words about who, you know, every book is, I'm told every book is supposed to have a foreword and it's supposed to be dedicated to someone, but I'm not really sure, you know, who this should be dedicated to. So he says, Andrew S. Anderson was the Democratic nominee for governor. A few weeks before election, he walked out into the pasture. The pasture was the domain ruled by the bull. The bull would not stand for any intrusion on his domain and hawked and bunted and trampled Mr. Anderson to death. This created a vacancy of the ticket, and the Democratic State Central Committee filled that vacancy by having my name printed on that ticket. Had the bull not created that vacancy, I never would have run for governor. If I had not run, I never would have been elected. Had I not been elected governor, I never would have run for nor been elected to the United States Senate. Had I never been elected to the Senate, the Democrats would never have had the chance to put me out of a job in 1942 and fix it so that I would have nothing to do but write a book. That roan bull was to blame for the whole thing, yet it was no premeditated aforethought on the part of the bull. He acted on the spur of the moment. He did not intend the consequences of his act. He apparently did not know what he was doing, so I do not feel like dedicating the book to the bull for accomplishing something that the bull did not intend.
Yeah.
Isn't that
it's
great?
Really the story about the bull is just crazy. But
yeah, South Dakota politics, baby. I mean, this is a guy who has somebody else take his entrance into law school, kind of winkles his way into success, and then sits back and says, well, now I can write a book because the Democrats voted me out, and there's too many of them to name here. So so he dedicates it to the reader, and now here we are. Tony Venhuizen, thank you so much. We really appreciate just this glimpse, and what a great edition of South Dakota History Journal. If you're not subscribing, we'll put a link up on our website so you can find that and get your subscription in today. Thanks, Tony.
You bet. Good to talk to you.
The keynote for Spearfishes, a National Endowment for Arts Big Read, takes place Thursday evening at 7 p.m. local time. Marcia Mittman of The Next Foundation presents on Ursula Le Guin's A Wizard of Tales, the author's affinity for Taoism and how its precepts are incorporated into her work. Marcia Mittman has been practicing a combination of Eastern philosophies and disciplines for the last 30 years. She's an author and memoirist herself and a South Dakota Humanities Council presenter. She joins us on the phone. Marcia Mittman, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you have done so much in your life, and the Eastern accent you have is only as far east as New York City, but you have gone...
New York, but I've lived here. I've been in Spearfish for 22 years
yes.
now. I'll just never get rid of the accent.
It's just there with you. You're a great humorist and a great thoughtful reader as well as writer. So tell me about your connection with Ursula Le Guin's work, especially... her book about where she translates or sort of expands on the Tao Te Ching.
I was sent to Japan in my late 20s. And initially when I was in college, I had taken this really heavy philosophy course, Socrates and the likes, the big guys. And I got involved while I was there with Eastern philosophy for the first time and found it fascinating. And I began practicing thereafter, and what I found interesting about Le Guin is that in this book, The Wizard of Earthsea, she is actually using Ged, the protagonist, as an example of how to incorporate this into your life. And the deeper I went into the book, I realized it is a step-by-step guidebook for a reader. Yes, it's a story, but she started practicing Taoism at age 14. Her mother was a practicing Taoist. And nobody today takes the time or can really take the time to read the original texts. And her genius was that she did something that's entertainment. She wrote a novel, but showed people how to incorporate this into their lives.
Yeah. Now, if you've seen the film adaptations of her books, she was pretty specific during her lifetime saying...
Very much so.
Yeah, they're very different. They were changed from people of color to white people. She had lots of problems with how those things were adapted. So really, you need to go back to the text to see this unfold. And often in the movies...
What's incredible it pulled out, in the text...
Yeah.
When I started writing the keynote, oh my God, I had like 45, 50 pages. It took me more time to cut than to write it because she's peppered the text with so much material. It isn't just the line of growth of the protagonist. It's all of the hints. So, for example, she's got the light versus dark constantly dealing with the balance. She even has the old practice of numerology in there, dealing with completion and transcendence. She has it's just woven intricately into the text, and it really is amazing. The text is extraordinary.
Yeah. Can you give us an example for people who don't know much about Taoism? Where does it begin? What was one of your first, connections and entries in it that you said, this isn't just something I want to read from a library book. This is something that I want to practice in the form of meditation or other practices. Yeah.
Taoism and yoga itself, not the yoga that people practice today, although I'm not denigrating it, you know, as mm-hmm. the exercise program, but these are disciplines. They say that Taoism even has some concepts of yoga in it. They're not religions. They were later incorporated into religions, but they themselves are just disciplines, and they teach you how to become aware of your own shortcomings and what to do to face them head on and to transcend them. And in so doing, you become a more well-rounded, a more compassionate person, become more aware of other people's problems, and eventually, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight, but eventually it leads to consciousness expansion and hopefully at some point transcendence. But, you know, that's a lot of work. But I just found that it's a very good way to live because I've learned to be more objective and I don't, like, succumb to my emotions immediately.
Right.
I find it very, very practical in everyday life.
Yeah. So the People of Spearfish is part of this, you know, the big read through the NEA, looking at the Wizard of Earthsea. Also, during a pandemic time, tell me a little bit about how these practices, how this teaching, and even how Ursula Le Guin's writing has sort of journeyed alongside you during a really difficult, isolating year.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I actually totally isolated. So next week is 14 months I've been isolating, and as a writer, for me it wasn't that bad. To be honest, it was wonderful because I got an awful lot done, more than I usually do when I'm running around. But you put things in perspective easier when you practice these, and you tend to look at the bigger picture, and you don't allow yourself to be overcome by emotion. You are more objective. You're able to look at things from the outside. And I feel that helps people in any emergency or in any situation where there are difficulties.
Yeah. I'll have what she's having, right?
Exactly.
All right.
This was a really brilliant woman.
Yeah. Marsha Mittman is with the Next Foundation. You can also have her come to your community virtually through the South Dakota Humanities Council, and she's delivering Spearfish's Big Read keynote address Thursday night at 7 p.m. You'll be able to watch that. We'll put some links up on our website, and we've been talking about the great author Ursula Le Guin and The Wizard of Earthsea. It's a series. Also, she wrote this great series called The Cat Wings books, which is my favorite, Ursula Le Guin. It's a children's series about cats that can fly. So, Marsha, we'll leave it here for now, but I hope you will come back and tell us what you have been working on during the pandemic, because we'd like to hear about your writing as well.
Thank you so much. I hope we all become wizards after this.
That's right. Let's strive. Or let's not strive for that, right? Oh, that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. Thanks for tuning in. And from Steve Zwemke and Chris Lawfrey and Joshua Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.